flooding. But what mainstream media is not talking about is the impact of that flooding on the Cooper Nuclear Power Station, just south of Omaha. As the Missouri River comes to within inches of flood level, which would trigger a mandatory shutdown of this Fukushima-style nuclear reactor, Nebraska Public Power District and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission insist everything is fine, everything is safe, no flooding has or will take place, they're there, Missy, don't worry your pretty little head about it. But then you hear from a different kind of expert, one who knows the history of previous floods at this nuclear reactor, and he tells you,
there is very likely water, flood water, coming into vaults with electrical cables and rooms that have safety-related electrical circuits. And right now they've got their pumps running at that facility, and they are pumping water out much like you would a bilge pump on a boat.
And there is history that proves that out. Well, given how thin the margins are between current flood level and mandatory shutdown, and the chance that there's flooding already, even if the river doesn't rise any further, you begin to realize that all of our posteriors are stuck in a seat, the one that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we examine what's going on with the floods surrounding the Cooper Nuclear Power Station near Omaha, Nebraska, with two interviews. The first is with Paul Gunter, Director of Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear, and he helps us understand previous floods and their impact on the reactor, and what might be going on there that no one is talking about. Then, Gail Snyder, Board President of Chicago-based Nuclear Energy Information Service, NEIS, gives us a glimpse of Cooper's and other nukes' possible future in the age of climate change. Then, just in a breaking story, Dave Kraft of NEIS shares a swift-moving nuclear juggernaut in the Illinois legislature, a bill that's poised there that could force nukes on us for decades to come. And without transparency, that bill is headed for a vote, possibly by the end of this week. Stay tuned for that one. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than is being discussed by any of the 5,000 Democrats who claim that they will be running for president in 2020. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, March 19, 2019, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. We're just going to start out with the big story here in the United States, where with record flooding in the Midwest, the Cooper Nuclear Station, which is on the Missouri River just south of Omaha, Nebraska, remains within inches of the level of water, 45.5 feet, that requires a shutdown. As of Friday, the facility was under a Nuclear Regulatory Commission unusual event status, which is step one in the four-step ladder to kiss your posterior goodbye. As of Friday, personnel with the Nebraska Public Power District have been sandbagging the levees that protect the nuclear plant to give it extra height, and also sandbagging the doorways of the plant and preparing watertight drop-down doors. A story in Friday's Omaha World Herald stated that the plant was in the process of shutting down or had shut down before being corrected to say they're preparing to shut down, but but they haven't done it yet. And indeed, the plant has been operating at 100% capacity throughout this entire flooding potential. As of 3 p.m. on Monday, March 18, the river was only about a foot and a half below the level that would require Cooper to be shut down. Though speaking with a person from the Nebraska Public Power District, he said the water levels are trending downward, which is good news. Nancy Faust of Simply Info reported that no precipitation is expected in South Dakota for the next week, this being upstream on the Missouri River. But she said it is warmer, so there will be more rapid thawing from the central part of the state and up into North Dakota this week. So inputs of water to Fort Calhoun, which is just upstream of Cooper, and Cooper would likely remain somewhat high as all of this melts. Cooper is right below where a bunch of rivers feed into the Missouri. To find out more about Cooper and its history and its dangers, we spoke with Paul Gunter. He's director of the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear and a longtime veteran of the anti-nuclear wars. In part, it's his knowledge of the history of Cooper Nuclear that makes his insights so valuable and at the same time so frightening. We spoke yesterday, Monday, March 18, 2019.
First of all, what was the situation last week at Cooper Nuclear Facility just south of Omaha on the Missouri River?
Due to the level of rainfall and snowmelt, the water table and the rivers in the area are swelling out of their banks, and so we've got flooding ongoing with particular focus on the Cooper Nuclear Power Station, which is just several miles south of Brownville, Nebraska, on the Missouri River. And the plant itself is built on a right next to the river so that it can get its cooling water from there. And it's at 903 feet above mean sea level. That's where the reactor floor is, basically. But there's whole sections of the reactor building that are below grade, as well as in the turbine hall. So we've been watching Cooper Nuclear Power Station as the floodwaters are continuing to mount and not expected to crest till later this week. We've already seen floodwaters up around 901 feet above mean sea level. But again, the concern's not necessarily just getting up to 903 feet where the reactor is, but we've got NRC reports back from the last flood, which was in June to July 1993, that shows evidence that water's probably coming in through cable vaults, you know, electrical cables that are below grade. We saw back in 1993 even flood water coming through the concrete walls that are below grade. So assortment of penetrations, and what the 1993 report said was that the flood water was essentially overwhelming the floor drains down there, and the water level was rising, impinging upon safety-related electrical circuits, that eventually even the control room started seeing warning lights of electrical circuits shorting out. Now, the concern here is that Cooper Station's still operating, and they're saying that they're going to shut down at 903 feet when the water gets up to 903 feet above mean sea level. But again, we've seen the floodwaters from earlier flooding essentially encroach upon safety systems much sooner. At 900.8 inches was when the flood stopped cresting back in 93.
Has there been any kind of safety upgrade post-Fukushima or post the floods that were so dangerous and came so close just a little ways upstream at Fort Calhoun in 2011?
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you know, is pretty laid back on this flooding. They essentially have turned over responsibility to self-regulation by the industry. Again, what we saw in 1993 was that as the floodwaters were rising on electrical circuits for things like the reactor cooling water injection system, that the NRC was not requiring any action. Post-Fukushima, the whole concern about flooding and seismic received an incredible amount of attention, particularly from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission's technical staff. But of concern today is that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, back in January 24th, 2019, essentially rolled back more than 7 years of technical study by its own agency, who wanted requirements for upgrades, which would essentially put the whole flooding and seismic upgrade into enforcement space, where the agency could penalize the operator for slow performance or not doing the activities. But instead, in a 3-2 vote by this particular commission, following along the partisan line of the Republican Party there, the commission voted to not require these upgrades through orders that were enforceable, but essentially, again, has fallen back to this, let the industry regulate itself, provided that upgrades could be treated as voluntary initiatives. In a post-Fukushima world, and again, Cooper Station is a GE Mark I boiling water reactor, essentially identical to Fukushima, that was overwhelmed by that tsunami following the earthquake. So that's the concern. So it's all really up to the utility to self-regulate how much they're willing to gamble in protecting their financial margins over public health and safety margins.
Now, last Friday, there were various reports that came out saying that they were planning on and preparing to shut down, that they had shut down, and that they hadn't shut down. What's the truth of the matter?
They are at 100% power right now on March 18th, 2019. So they did not shut down. Again, we don't have hard and solid regulations. This is a voluntary initiative. I can tell you that they have done some upgrades, yes, post-Fukushima, under this voluntary system, but that doesn't provide us with confidence because it's a voluntary program, so they're without any kind of enforcement consequence if they should be laggards on this, or if their financial bottom line is more important than fully raising the safety bar around this inherently dangerous industry. But the fact is that we know from earlier floods at this very nuclear power station that they were getting flood water coming through concrete and also through penetrations with electrical cabling vaults that are in and around the nuclear power station. They're not being required to fully protect at a level of regulation that has enforcement space. You know, it's still kind of laid back. The utility has the upper hand on things like extreme flooding events and even seismic events.
What about the spent fuel pools? Is there any danger to them from the flooding or the flooding potential that currently exists? And does that extend up north to Fort Calhoun, which is shuttered but still has fuel on site?
Right now, the electrical grid has not been affected by the flood. So all safety systems, primary safety systems, are getting electrical power, and as the plant is fully operational at 100% power right now. The spent fuel pool is also getting power from the electrical grid for circulating the water that keeps hundreds of tons of irradiated nuclear waste, the fuel assemblies, cool. So right now there's no concern other than, you know, this stuff is really thermally hot and extremely radioactive. But all safety systems are go right now with this particular hazard. Fort Calhoun is also still receiving its electrical power, even though it's completely shut down, but the electrical power for spent fuel pool cooling is ongoing there as well. So there's no concern there. Again, the concern is that the nuclear power station at full power has all this heat from the fissioning process that will take some time to cool down in the event that they, for one reason, either from an off-site loss of electrical power from the grid or from some on-site event like electrical short from floodwater getting into electrical circuits. These are the kinds of circumstances that will put us on emergency footing.
NPPD, Nebraska Public Power District, has said that as of this morning, Monday, when we're speaking, the water level is at 899.75 feet, which is only a foot and three quarters away from where they have said that they would initiate the shutdown procedure. Are we out of the woods yet? Is the flooding expected to continue? Might it rise? Or should we all breathe a sigh of relief at this point?
I don't think you can ever breathe a sigh of relief for nuclear power stations. It's really about maintaining the highest level of vigilance. The consequences are completely unforgiving. And we expect our Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the operators, per their license agreements, to keep this plant at the highest level of vigilance. So, no, we're never out of the woods with an inherently dangerous technology. But what we're seeing is that there's not the level of transparency for the Cooper Nuclear Power Station that we think should be there, even though they're below 900 feet above mean sea level. There is very likely water, flood water, coming into vaults with electrical cables and rooms that have safety-related electrical circuits. And right now they've got their pumps running at that facility, and they are pumping water out much like you would a bilge pump on a boat. So things are working, but there are safety margins that are gathered by putting that nuclear power station at zero power. So we're being vigilant about this plant. It would be a lot safer at zero power, but they're not required at this point by the flood stage that the Missouri River is expected to supersede. So we expect that the nuclear power station will be looking at shutting down, but that trigger point hasn't been reached in its technical specs. But again, we're pretty confident that water is coming in to the basement, into the reactor building basement there at Cooper Station right now. And the pumps are working, and let's hope they continue.
Anything else you would like to add?
Again, you know, we're really concerned that the Fukushima nuclear disaster, which was principally an earthquake followed by extreme severe flooding from the tsunami, hasn't really jolted the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission into rising the safety bars around nuclear facilities in this country. The idea that we never grounded the GE Mark I following Fukushima is a startling wake-up call to those who are monitoring this inherently dangerous industry. There are circumstances, particularly that are heightened right now, because the GE design itself, we know from earlier Atomic Energy Commission and then Nuclear Regulatory Commission reports, that if this containment system is confronted with a severe accident, it's very, very likely to fail by design, by lack of design. The containment itself is too small volumetrically to contain all of the force and radiation and heat and pressure that's created in an accident. These plants should have been retired immediately in the wake of Fukushima, but they're just pushing these plants for financial gain, essentially, while safety margins are, again, being turned over to the judgment of the utilities, much like, Boeing might decide to keep the 737 MAX operating here in the United States while it was being shut down everywhere else around the world. These are the same kind of circumstances now that we have as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is moving from prescriptive regulations, which, you know, are enforceable, to risk-based regulation, which put things in some kind of balance between dueling risk models between the utility and the regulators. And so you don't really see clear, bright lines for enforcement action. So this is the sort of limbo that we're in right now as floodwaters are rising around Cooper Station.
Well, it's clear that this is not the end of this particular story, and we will keep following it, and Paul will stay in touch for any further developments.
Thank you very much.
That was Paul Gunter, director of the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear. While Paul brought us up to date on past problems and current dangers at Cooper, Gail Snyder, board chair of Chicago's NEIS, Nuclear Energy Information Service, addresses what the future may look like for Cooper and all other nuclear reactors. We spoke just moments ago, on Tuesday, March 19, 2019.
Phoebe, I think what we're seeing here with the Cooper Nuclear Power Facility in Nebraska flooding is a glimpse into what our future is. It is a not-so-dry run of what we're going to be looking at as scientists are telling us that the climate is changing and weather extremes are going to continue, including flooding. So as we look over the landscape of the country and the nuclear reactors and the natural disasters that can impact them, from flooding along these rivers to hurricanes, we see that we are in for a future that is going to be really dramatically impacting nuclear power plants. In 34 and a half years, the nuclear power plant in Nebraska, the Cooper one, its license expires. So we have, just with that one facility, we have the next 34 years to look at what are the weather conditions going to be that are impacting that nuclear facility. Are we going to continue to see floods like this every year? Are they going to get worse? I mean, they are within really inches when the river has peaked there in Nebraska. We were within inches of where they are going to shut down the nuclear plant. So next year, maybe they're going to be a foot over. Maybe the next year after that, a few feet over. We just don't know. We know that in the next 12 years, scientists are saying that we need to do something dramatic to stop climate change and to halt it where it is. And it doesn't look like we're progressing very well. So right now, the NRC staff has recommended fixes, which the NRC Commission is not implementing. Two commissioners dissented against the balance of the commissioners at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and Commissioner Burns added that, according to the Washington Post, he said, "The accident in Fukushima was a direct result of the operator and regulator failing to take attention to account for new scientific knowledge related to natural hazards, especially flooding hazards. In the United States, there exists incontrovertible evidence that the current design basis for some plants do not address a flood hazard identified by the licensee, which is the plant operator." So what we're looking at, so across the nation, is states trying to come to terms with their energy policy. The Trump administration is saying that it is possibly going to bail out coal and nuclear plants, and as states trying to get ahead of that and figure out what they are going to do to implement their energy policies in their states, they have, and they continue to, consider what they can do to keep nuclear plants operating. So they're doing bailouts. Our state, we're coming up with a new creative solution to try and keep nuclear plants operating as the state builds out more renewable energy. But states are not thinking about how climate change is affecting the nuclear industry and nuclear reactors. We have nuclear reactors that shut down when it's too hot because the water is too hot to use, and we have nuclear plants that shut down when they're too wet and there's too much water around them. Right now, the community in Nebraska and other states are suffering with historic flooding. they are under tremendous pressure and burden just to deal with the flooding in their communities and what is happening with levees breaking and levees not being able to be fixed. According to Chicago Tribune, they quote Tom Bullock, the emergency management director for Missouri's Polk County, and he says they aren't even to the wet season yet. And he says the water isn't going to be gone and the levees aren't going to be fixed this year. So we are still going to get inundated along that area, and we don't really know what is going to happen in the next coming months with just the Cooper nuclear reactor. This is something states need to consider when they're looking at subsidizing nuclear plants and any way to keep them operating, because it's not just what's going to happen in the next 5 years. It's the next 10, 15, and 20 years and weather impacting those reactors.
That was Gail Snyder, board chair of Chicago's NEIS. My talk with Gail led to discovering a breaking situation in Illinois, and you will learn about that during this week's regular interview segment. Just two additional thoughts about Cooper. From listener Bill Smyrno, he said, it's good to keep an eye on the National Weather Channel. They said that they expect the flooding to remain at extremely high levels at least until this coming weekend. So yes, we will be checking with the Weather Channel. And in last Friday's World Herald article that I quoted earlier, it said that Cooper accounts for about 35% of NPPD's power. That's Nebraska Public Power District. It went on to read, after the plant shuts down, NPPD will get power elsewhere through its own facilities or through a power-sharing network that it belongs to. And then Mark Becker, a spokesman for the Nebraska Public Power District, said, that's not going to be an issue. We're going to have enough electricity. So if you're going to have enough electricity without Cooper, why in the world are you risking a nuclear situation by keeping it running during a potential flooding situation? Inquiring minds want to know. In other U.S. nuclear news this week, in Connecticut, Dominion Energy was set to shut down Connecticut's Millstone nuclear reactor, saying that it would if it did not secure a new contract by March 15. And Connecticut blinked. Dominion got a new contract, a 10-year deal, and the damn thing's going to stay open as, quote, part of a clean energy solicitation. I'm going to have to go see a dentist to repair the damage all this gnashing is doing to my teeth. In California, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission is being sued for withholding documents related to an August accident at the San Onofre nuclear facility north of Oceanside. San Diego attorney Mike Aguirre is suing for withholding documents he requested last year under the Freedom of Information Act. He said the regulators have refused to release records related to a near-miss accident at SANO in August that left a 50-ton container filled with radioactive waste perched precariously 18 feet above the floor of its intended storage area. Aguirre also claimed the NRC is withholding documents that contain details about how the plant owner, Southern California Edison, allegedly violated nuclear waste rules for months prior to that misalignment. To which the NRC responded, no comment. In Pennsylvania, as community members and activists from around the world prepare to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor partial meltdown, Pennsylvania legislators have introduced a bill to shore up two money-losing nuclear power plants, including Three Mile Island, as well as Beaver Valley. The proposal is facing pushback from ratepayer advocates, natural gas producers, and environmental groups that say that it's a flawed approach to place nuclear power plants under the state's alternative energy portfolio standard. Meanwhile, studies have shown that Pennsylvania has had one of the highest thyroid cancer rates in recent years, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Meanwhile, pro-nukers, including NRC shill Neil Sheehan, said, insist that the radioactive releases during the accident, quote, were at such a low level that they would not be expected to have any sort of ill health effects. But the linear no-threshold model, which has been the basis for understanding the impact of radiation on the human body, states that there is no such thing as a safe level of radiation exposure. We're also going to link to an article on cancer and infant mortality at Three Mile Island by John LaForge, co-director of Nuke Watch. And in a more subtly pro-nuke worded article that appeared in PenLive.com and was written by Wallace McKelvey, the headline tips his hat. It says, "What will become of Three Mile Island's nuclear waste if the plant closes?" Not when, which activists and sane people are pushing for, but if. In discussing the stainless steel casks for dry storage, he talks about the thick stainless steel casks, which directly contradict the fact that if they are Holtec, they are only 5/8 of an inch in diameter and are referred to by those in the know around San Onofre who have been battling this for a long time as the thin stainless steel casks, or as I like to call them, the tin cans. And throughout the article, he emphasizes all of the positives, that it's a tentative shutdown date, and we'll know more if the company moves ahead this year to permanently shut down the plant. Watch out for the subtle propaganda, because it's a killer. The director of Nevada's Agency for Nuclear Projects told lawmakers on Friday, March 15, that the state will continue to fight to block the Yucca Mountain project at every possible turn. Director Bob Halstead made it clear that even though the Trump administration wants to restart the licensing process, Yucca isn't remotely ready to begin accepting shipments of radioactive waste. He said, "What exists today at Yucca Mountain is only a 5-mile exploratory tunnel that cannot be used for waste storage or disposal." Halstead went on to say that Nevada has 218 challenges to the application and plans to submit 50 more. He estimated that it would take more than 400 hearing days to plow through those challenges, plus time for discovery, motions, and appeals. The estimated cost of the proceedings would be $1.66 billion to the Energy Department, $330 million to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and only $50 million to Nevada, which they are very happy to take on. He finally said, "We expect the full legally mandated proceeding to go 5 years and cost $2 billion, and we expect to defeat the Energy Department on the facts, because the site is unsuitable for geologic storage." And in Arizona, a crematorium has tested hot for radioactive contamination, and its likely source is a cremated man who was treated for cancer shortly before dying, this according to a new study. The results weren't surprising to Mark O'Kaltofen, a nuclear scientist at the Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts, who was not involved in the study. He said, "They only happened to catch this one case because normally they don't look. Just another example of how radioactivity is the gift that keeps giving and giving and giving, even if we don't want it to." And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
All those aging nuclear reactors here in the U.S. are just getting older, but still, the nuclear industry is pushing for deregulation and are trying to convince federal regulators to scale back safety inspections and limit what lower-level issues are reported to the public. Requests from the Nuclear Energy Institute requested such changes as shifting to more self-assessments, cutting back on public disclosures for problems at plants, and reducing what they call the, quote, burden of radiation protection and emergency preparedness inspections. WTF? They want the fox to guard the hen house even more than it already is. And as for the burden of radiation protection and emergency preparedness inspections, burden on whom? Certainly not the public, which deserves to know about this, but shh, they don't want you knowing about that either. The Trump Nuclear Regulatory Commission appointees and industry reps say changes in oversight are warranted to reflect the industry's overall improved safety records and financial difficulties. Well, first of all, if there's an improved safety record, don't you think that's because they've been having these regular inspections, which must be made transparently visible to the public? And if they're not making money, hey, this is still capitalism. You don't make money, the business shuts down, and then you have to clean up your mess. So shame on all of those who are pushing to make us less safe as nukes get older, more decrepit, more embrittled, and more prone to having problems. And all of you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
Over to Japan, where Miyagi prefectural commissioners have stricken down a planned referendum in Miyagi to allow citizens to vote as to whether they agree to the restart of the Onangawa nuclear reactors or not. Onangawa is the nuclear plant closest to the location of the 3/11/11 quake epicenter and was severely damaged in the same accident that took out the Fukushima Daiichi triple reactors. In Onangawa, the event was initially reported as a level 3 accident, but all information regarding the accident has been scrubbed from the internet. There were apparently over 110,000 signatures to have a vote on whether the reactor should be reopened or not, but the commissioners in their quote-unquote wisdom decided that they knew better and canceled the vote. A new study shows that there was a significant increase in the number of infants in Japan who had surgery for complex congenital heart disease after the nuclear accident in Fukushima. Researchers analyzed data in complex congenital heart disease operations in children between 2007 and 2014. In the 4 years after Fukushima, the number of these operations in infants across Japan increased just over 14%. Which brings to mind the study by epidemiologist Joseph Mangano and Dr. Janet Sherman on changes in congenital anomaly incidence in West Coast and Pacific states of the United States after the arrival of Fukushima fallout. This is a study from 2015, and we will link to it on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 404. There are doctors in Japan who are determined to track down exactly what Fukushima did to its people. And now the Japan Society of Obstetrics and Gynecology on March 2nd adopted a proposal to increase the number of institutions that can conduct non-invasive prenatal testing to detect chromosomal abnormalities in unborn babies. Over 90% of women whose unborn babies are confirmed to have chromosomal abnormalities choose to abort them. And in a possibly related story, births in Japan in 2018 have hit a new low, with fewer than 1 million babies born for the third year in a row. We're working on an interview on these issues for Nuclear Hot Seat. Also in Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, baby, said that Japan is approaching the, quote, final stages of its effort to rebuild areas devastated by the earthquake and tsunami in 2011. This article virtually does not even mention the meltdown at Fukushima Daiichi or the levels of radiation that the area is still subject to. Fortunately, even after Abe is saying that the recovery is almost over, polls show that more than half the public in Japan is unconvinced. And this numbnuts adjacent story, the Tokyo 2020 Radioactive Olympics has established a smoke-free policy at all Olympic and Paralympic venues. You can breathe in radioactive particles still floating around in the dust from Fukushima Daiichi's meltdowns, but you can't smoke tobacco. Internationally, in Western Australia, traditional owners, that's the equivalent of First Nations or Native Americans, traditional owners and the Conservation Council of Western Australia are continuing their fight against a proposed uranium mine, fearing unique subterranean fauna in the project area will be made extinct if it proceeds. Former State Environment Minister Albert Jacob gave the green light to Cameco's Yeelirrie mine proposal in January of 2017. but the legal precedent has much broader implications, according to CCWA Director Pierre Verstegen. And he said, "We're certainly very keen to be upholding environmental laws, which were never intended to be used by a minister or a government to approve the extinction of a species." Russia and China have picked up the lying pro-nuclear trope that nuclear is a clean power fix, and they're promoting it to Africa. We'll have a link to that article up on our website. Two other links which should be read in conjunction with each other. The first from Business Insider is, "Here's what you should do if a nuclear bomb explodes nearby." Other than kiss your posterior goodbye, it's normalizing the thought that we can have little tiny nukes to use. And on the other hand, an interesting article, "So what really happens when you pop a nuke over Topeka?" It's from Daily Kos. It'll be on the website. We'll have another of this week's featured interviews in just a moment. But first, it's official. Thanks to many, many listeners of this program, you know who you are. You've been very generous, and the necessary funds have been raised to cover the expenses of getting me to Three Mile Island for the 40th anniversary of that nuclear meltdown, and at the same time keep me housed and fed with a little bit of transportation while I'm there. I am so grateful for your help and support, because I literally couldn't do this trip without you. I leave this Friday for Middletown, Pennsylvania, for a week of conferences, panel discussions, a vigil at the gates of TMI, networking, and interviews with activist representatives from around the world, as well as the victims of Three Mile Island who still live there. Then I'll be bringing you the full story directly from those who lived through that horrifying experience and still live with its aftermath. Of course, after Three Mile Island, Nuclear Hot Seat will continue, along with its expenses. That means that as we move forward, I will still be needing your assistance with a donation of any size to meet our monthly operating costs. We make it easy for you to help out. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the big red donate button, and make a one-time donation or set up an automatic recurring donation of any size. And if you happen to be on a budget, and who isn't these days, there's also a big green donate button that, with just a few simple clicks, allows you to set up a recurring donation of $5 a month, about the same as you would pay for a decent cup of coffee in a nice place plus a tip. So whatever you have done to help, and whatever you can do to help keep Nuclear Hot Seat up and running, you have my deepest gratitude. Here's this week's other featured interview. One never knows where the next nuclear story is going to come from. And in asking Gail Snyder to talk about global warming and nukes, she told me of a breaking situation in Illinois, along with the right person to fill us in, Dave Kraft, Executive Director of NEIS, Nuclear Energy and Information Service. Right now, there is a speed stealth move by the nuclear industry to guarantee its survival even after reactor closures have been mandated, because maybe it can all be circumvented. I spoke with Dave just as we were going into recording today, Tuesday, March 19, 2019.
Dave Kraft of NEIS, great to be able to talk with you today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks, good to be here.
You're in the middle of an emergency response to some legislation that's coming up in Illinois. Tell us what it's about and what it means in terms of the future of nuclear, not just in Illinois, but possibly everywhere in the United States.
Yeah, I wanted to start with that as a backdrop. The nuclear age is pretty much over. We see reactors closing, they're aging, no new ones are being built, certainly not in the United States of any consequence. But you can't tell nuclear executives that. They're always going to find a way to try and bleed that last dollar out of the remaining reactors that are there. And one of the ways they're attempting to do that nationwide is by using the climate issue as the fig leaf for why we need nuclear power. We have seen over the last few years different ways that the industry tries to do that. And in Illinois, we have the nation's largest nuclear utility, Exelon Corporation, which operates 11 reactors and has three closed reactors here. They also operate in other states, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New England. And the situation is that every opportunity Exelon gets to try and get money from other sources, it does. In 2016, in Illinois, we passed some legislation which resulted in the construction, or soon-to-be construction, of a lot of renewable energy resources like wind and solar and expansion of energy efficiency, but it came at a price. The environmental community was not allowed, I guess you could say, to proceed in the legislature unless Exelon got its pound of flesh, and that amounted to a $2.3 billion bailout for three nuclear reactors in Illinois that otherwise would have closed because they weren't economically competitive. So that happened in 2016. It was a process that got drawn out over a few years. Well, I think Exelon realized it used up a lot of political chips to get that bailout back then. Now, fast forward a little bit to 2019, and Exelon is using a new situation and a much more creative method of extracting more money out of ratepayers, not through the traditional bailout method, which they're still using in Pennsylvania and New Jersey and elsewhere, but through a mechanism called the capacity market price. With the Trump administration appointing members to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, we see that one of their main projects right now is to bail out the fossil fuel industry, namely coal, to a lesser extent, nuclear power. And there were various approaches that were proposed by FERC to the different regional transmission authorities like PJM, which is a large market responsible for a sizable portion of electricity generation in the eastern part of the United States. There's a method that is used for any power plant to recover money. Now, of course, the first method is you sell electrons, and that's what coal plants, oil plants, and nuclear plants do, and the renewable energy resources. Currently, those resources get things called ZECs. These are zero emission credits, and renewable energy resources get RECs, renewable energy credits, under the capacity market system. So these two would be at a disadvantage if the Trump administration attempts to bail out the coal industry. So they have a problem there, and Exelon decided to take it to the legislature for a creative solution. They were saying, woe is us and woe is the renewables. These are the great low-carbon resources that would be penalized if FERC and PJM and the Trump administration mess with the market and bail out the coal plants. There's a legal way around it, and that is if the state of Illinois itself would create its own capacity market, which would reward the so-called clean energy resources of nuclear and renewables, along the same way that PJM is awarding it, except it would be a local thing, which would essentially squeeze out the coal and fossil plants and reward the renewables and nuclear plants with these ZECs and RECs. So it's kind of a complicated issue here. It's not directly going to the legislature with, you know, hat in hand and handout saying, bail us out. It's saying, we provide this resource, which is low carbon in its generation of electricity, and wouldn't it be awful if that went away? So we need to create our own market here and reward us for essentially that wonderful public service. And that's what Exelon is doing in Illinois. So that's different than what they did in the past. The problem comes in is that because of the politics here in Illinois, neither Exelon nor the renewables sector has the political clout anymore to get things done on their own. So they have kind of teamed up in a way. They've been talking and negotiating about points that they would agree on and points they would disagree on, and they've come up with a new legislative proposal called CEJA, C-E-J-A, the Clean Energy Jobs Act, which essentially sets up these two Illinois markets to reward nuclear and renewables. Again, it's another political trade-off. It's kind of duress, since the renewables folks know that they can't get anything without Exelon's help, and vice versa, that Exelon's nukes won't be protected from the Trump administration if it goes sour. So they're teaming up together on legislation that would reward these plants.
These seem like extremely odd bedfellows to have in any kind of an energy situation. How did that come about, and how are they working with each other? What are they trying to accomplish next?
It was a recognition that, politically speaking, neither Exelon had the power anymore to flat out get bailed out with any kind of market solution. The renewables folks also are up against the Exelon lobbyists, who historically have prevented a lot of renewable energy from being put online. So it's this sort of unholy alliance to make sure that anything the Trump administration might do or anything the FERC might do would not keep the fossil industry around any longer than necessary, but would provide the funds to not only enhance renewables, which it certainly does quite a bit, but also guarantees that the nuclear plants will be getting a so-called market-based payment through the capacity market up until presumably the end of their operating licenses, which in some cases go out to the year 2048. That locks the money train in place during that period for the nuclear plants, and that's where the problem comes in for us.
How fast is this moving forward? When did you find out about it, and what is in the immediate future?
The bill itself, the so-called CEJA bill, was introduced in late February. It's over 365 pages long. It is partially the product of conversations and negotiations that were going on with members of the environmental community, the renewable energy community, different agencies which protect consumer rights on the one hand, and the Exelon lobbyists and negotiators on the other hand. So it's been going on just for a matter of weeks. However, the bills have been introduced, they're being called up in committees now, and there's a good chance that they're going to be voted on within the next week or two. Our legislative session ends at the end of May, so unless something happens to pass this legislation before then, the issue would be dead. But it's moving pretty fast, and it is going through committee process now.
In your view, what's the best thing that could be done about this proposed legislation? And what is NEIS, hopefully not by yourselves, but if necessary so, what is NEIS doing to take that action?
Because we're not at the table, we're a kind of marginal player in Illinois compared to other larger, more well-known groups like Sierra Club and NRDC and others. All we can do really is go down there and just tell the truth. And the tack we are taking is pointing out that if the legislature artificially props up nuclear with plants that were scheduled to close or were economically distressed enough to close, all that does is it delays the inevitable. It also keeps those plants going, which create the liabilities of increased nuclear waste, the potential for accidents. And most importantly, we think, is folks need to realize that for every nuclear plant that continues to operate, that's how much less renewable energy is going to be built. So all we can do is go down there and tell the legislators that and hope that they will understand that we are ending the nuclear age. We can't create an energy future by bailing out the past. It's time to cut bait at this point on nuclear and really go full speed ahead and whole hog on the renewable energy future that's inevitable, not just in Illinois, but around the country and worldwide. Whether they will respond to that, hard to say, because politics is very weird here in Illinois.
As it is everywhere else. Dave, this is a very complex issue. I know it's not the last that we have heard about it. We'll stay in touch. And thanks for making yourself available in the midst of creating all of these materials for your presentation downstate at the legislature and being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much.
That was Dave Kraft, Executive Director of NEIS, the Chicago-based Nuclear Energy Information Service. We will let you know what happens with this fast-moving story. Activist shout-out! For those of you going to Harrisburg for the Three Mile Island 40th anniversary, if you can make it to no other event, please attend the Penn State Harrisburg Half-Day Conference, TMI 40, honoring the community and the legacy of the accident at Three Mile Island. Arne Gunderson of Fair Winds Energy Education will provide the keynote. There's a community panel entitled Art, Journalism, and Activism, which will include Eric Epstein, chair of Three Mile Island Alert, and Hiroko Aihara, an independent journalist from Fukushima. There will also be a panel discussion entitled Health, Action, and Public Policy, and a display of curated memorabilia at the Penn State Harrisburg Library. A lot of work has gone into creating these commemorations, and I hope you'll be able to attend. And I look forward to seeing and meeting many of you there. And for those of you who can't attend, of course, I will be reporting on all the activities for a future Nuclear Hot Seat. Here's today's final thought. I am all thought out. Everyone, especially if you are in the flood zones, be safe out there. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, March 19, 2019. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, and our friend Hervé Courtois, miningawareness.wordpress.com, WITF.org, greentechmedia.com, penlive.com, nevadaappeal.com, commondreams.org, buzzfeednews.com, counterpunch.org, dailycause.com, japantimes.co.jp, mybucketlistevents.com. We won't be going there very often. Hangurin no Kai, medicalexpress.com, scirp.org, apigf.org, Beyond Nuclear International, Scientific American, sbs.org, moneyweb.co.za, Counterpunch, Time Magazine, sciencealert.com, Business Insider, psychcentral.com, the soul-dead cubicle drones who push propaganda for world nuclear news under the guise of writing press releases, and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Personal thanks for help on the Cooper story to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and supporters Laura Lynch, Bill Smirnoff, and Erica Gray. And for the Onangawa story, gratitude to listener Frank Lehman in Japan. And thanks to all of you for listening, with a big shout out to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world in 123 countries on 6 continents and counting. And for those of you in our growing network of broadcast stations around the U.S., welcome to you as well. And if you know a local community broadcast station that's looking for programming specifically about nuclear, put them in touch at info@nuclearhotseat.com. Now, if you haven't done so already, go to our Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook page. Make certain that you like it, share it, feel free to respond to a post, and if you leave a comment, the chances are real good that I'll be responding to it. Don't miss out on a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. The way to do that is easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down to the yellow box, and put in your first name and your email address. And once a week, I will send you an email link to the latest show. Now, you are all part of my reporting network, as you heard from those people who tagged in on the story this week. So if you, yes, you listening right there, are in an area and you come across a nuclear story and have a lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, let me know about it. Send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment and send a donation of any size to Nuclear Hot Seat. You can find the red and the green donate buttons on our website, nuclearhotseat.com. We will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby Halevy and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevy of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that even if we solve the problems of global warming, we're still going to be left with radioactive nuclear waste, with no way to get rid of it and no way to store it safely. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep. Please don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.